This podcast is brought to you by Amusement Warehouse Magazine, the industry's largest trade publication. We cover amusement parks, carnivals, fairs, festivals, history, safety columns. We really got it all when it comes to the amusement business. Only remaining print publication in the amusement industry on a regular basis. So if you're interested in what the amusement industry has to offer, subscribe today. You can subscribe by logging on to amusementwarehouse.com, carnivalwarehouse.com, or amusementparkwarehouse.com. Welcome to another edition of the Amusement Warehouse Podcast. Today, we are super excited to have with us Renee Alexander, from the CEO of the Minnesota State Fair, fairly new to the position, a couple of years as the head honcho there, one of our largest state fairs, most beloved. People are fanatical about your event, which is great, including people on our side of the business. They just love it. Welcome. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks. Thanks so much for having me. It's great to be here.
I see you have your old admission price there, 25 cents still.
25 cents. It's been a little while since it's been 25 cents.
You famously have one of the most tight gates in the country. You don't let a lot of people in for free. I had some experience. I worked a little bit with Rick Burnett at the Ohio State Fair. And of course, I know Jim Sinclair and I know Jerry over the years. But they took such pride in how everybody pays in Minnesota. And where'd that come from? Is it just develop over the years, or where did you?
You know, yeah. I mean, I think it goes way back. I'm not sure what. Precluded that to be the case, but it certainly is something that we are still proud of. And, you know, all of our vendors have a ticket. I have a ticket to come in every day. So it's something, you know, our attendance is we're counting everybody because everybody's got a ticket.
That's good. So if you forget it, they don't let you in. You got to come out of pocket, go to the front
right?
gate.
It's got to happen.
That's the, when Rick was in Ohio, he was trying to do the same thing. And the one year at opening, he had a skydiver flew into the fair, and then they were joshing. They're like, "Oh, do you have a ticket?" And the guy, he pulled the ticket out of his jumpsuit or whatever. I thought that was pretty clever.
That's perfect. That's great.
That was pretty clever. So you've been at the fair quite a while. You started as like an intern or something.
I did.
Or something.
Yeah. So kind of my fair story. You know, I was born in Southeast Kansas. I remember going to the Crawford County Fair in Girard, Kansas with my cousins when I was a kid, and then moved to Minnesota. My dad worked for General Motors. We moved here when I was 8 years old. And I remember coming to the fair as a kid, sitting on the curb, watching the parade, and you know, just enjoying the fair. My first concert was at the Minnesota State Fair grandstand when I was in high school. Same year I saw Kenny Loggins and I saw Alabama. So,
who was the first concert? Alabama, you're saying?
Alabama. Yep. Yep. And then Kenny Loggins was also that year as well. But you know, it never
occurred to me. The fair staple. Alabama's been doing fairs
for. How many times? I think they hold the record for most appearances at the Minnesota State Fair. So
probably all fairs, just about. They're just like a staple for fairs. They've been great for the industry.
Exactly. So, but you know, it never occurred to me that it was a job, that people worked here and made this happen. And so I was.
Yeah, how can people only work 2 weeks a year?
Right. Yeah. I just assume people showed up, you know, around the 1st of August, flipped on the lights and this magical place appeared. So
is that like the number one question you get? Like, what do you do the other weeks?
Yeah. It's like, is that a full-time gig? You do that year round? There's how many people that work there all year long?
Cracks me up.
So yeah. Yeah. Not an uncommon question. So, so I was a communications major at UW River Falls, just right across the river in Western Wisconsin. And I needed an internship in order to graduate. And I had a friend of mine from college had a family member that worked here. So I actually interviewed with, you mentioned Jim Sinclair. I actually interviewed with Jim Sinclair to work this summer in the sales department, and he did not hire me. He did.
What a meanie. Oh my gosh.
Right. So
Jim is not good at picking talent, you're saying.
you know what? He did me a favor because I then ended up interviewing with Karen Leach, who was overseeing our free entertainment department, and she hired me. And so I worked that summer. You know, you talk about skydivers. I had a high wire walker in the office. You know, met some of the folks from, I mean, this was back in 1989, met folks from the Royal American Midway shows.
Yeah, I was going to ask you a little bit about that later.
Yeah, yeah. So, I mean, and I just fell in love with working here and being part of creating something that was so much bigger than anything I could ever do on my own. And just this magical place that, you know, as you mentioned, I mean, it means so much to the people of Minnesota. So it was really a great experience for a summer intern. And then I was actually hired full time. So I was here for 5 years doing free entertainment, and then left for about, decided to spread my wings, went out into the world of event production, worked for Sesame Street Live, was a corporate meeting planner,
oh, wow.
Worked for GL Berg Entertainment for a very brief time, determined I enjoyed purchasing entertainment better than I did selling entertainment. And then almost 20 years ago, I got a call to come back as entertainment director. So, and I said, this time I'm not leaving. So came back booking the Grandstand Entertainment, which full circle, thinking about that being the first show I ever saw. And just kind of, you know, worked up the ranks in leadership, you know, never really with my eye on the corner office, but here I am. So it's definitely
on your way to the top. Yeah, Mike, well, you are too, but Mike Heffern was there, who is a kind of a legend in this business, obviously, and his son Adam is now Ohio State Fair manager. And you had Rick Furnett, Jim Sinclair, and Jerry Hammer were kind of the three amigos there that were there for so long. And you have such a deep bench of talent at the Minnesota State Fair and everybody seems to stay there forever or come back if they leave.
Absolutely. It's
definitely a special place, I'm imagining.
Yeah, there's no question about it. And I'm, you know, very fortunate to, you know, I'm standing on the shoulders of giants. You know, you mentioned some folks that were, you know, have been really key, you know, people in our industry and really leaders. And I was fortunate enough to learn a lot from all of them and have their support and mentorship.
Yeah, Mike was so approachable too, because even as I think we graduated about the same time. So we're probably close to the same age. But Mike, you know, even when I was a young guy in the business, he would talk to you and discuss stuff with you. Like, you know, if I didn't know that he was a manager of a huge event in our industry, you know, you'd think he wouldn't have two minutes for you. But he was always great.
He was great. And it's funny when I made the decision to leave the fair, I mean, he was so kind. And he said, if you ever need anything, even if it's just a cheeseburger, let me know. So, you know, just very generous with his time and knowledge. And I really learned a lot from him and from Jerry Hammer too, you know, who followed him and was in this role for 27 years. So again, standing on the shoulders of giants.
So he was going to help you no matter what that mean old Sinclair said.
Right. Yeah. And Jim and I are good pals now. So I said, he did me a favor. If I would have, you know, gone into the sales department, I probably would have been there for a summer and that would have been it. So,
was your biggest mistake ever not hiring Renee for her internship? Is that a big flaw in your career?
No, not at all.
So when you came, that's interesting too, because you had Royal American shows. Did you realize like what a big deal they were back then? I was just doing a history one, so it's top of mind about how huge Royal American Shows was back in the day. What a big deal it was, the Settlemyer family and all those people.
No, I mean, you know, and I think that's true of a lot of history, right? I mean, you don't realize it when you're living it. Yeah, when you're living it. But, you know, I think one of my other early memories is, you know, one of the first fist fights I ever saw was under the arch of the Royal American Midway. So, you know, I mean, I think that was, you know, the carnival was considered this edgy place that you went and, you know, with the sideshows and everything else. But yeah, I mean, what a tremendous history to have Royal American be here for as long as they were.
Yeah, it was like a long, 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 long time. I forget.
Yeah. The number, yeah, it really was.
It was forever. And they were such a big deal, you know, mm-hmm. back in the day, one of the train shows mm-hmm. and doing all that stuff. And then you wound up going with an independent Midway.
Yep.
Sinclair had a lot to do with.
He did.
Planning out and doing. And he was kind of the scourge of the carnival business for a little while. He's doing this independent thing, but Texas has been independent for forever, but
yeah,
you guys joining it was a big move. And if you really, are you real involved with the independent Midway? You know, was that one of the challenges you took on because you didn't have that much experience with that aspect of the business?
Not personally. I mean, I think I'm certainly adjacent to it. And, I've had the fortunate ability to be able to spend some time with Jim down in the Midway. I mean, and my years leading up to this role, you know, I would spend an evening down there and, you know, learned about weighing tickets and, you know, just the whole process. So, and the layout and all that, I know enough to be dangerous, but, we're lucky to have folks that are really experts in the industry. And, you know, Jim has brought along Nikki Hines and some others to really, you know, it takes a village to do any of the work that we do in this business. No, it's not easy. Yeah.
I'm never going to mention that when I was thinking of with ticketing. You just mentioned, so, but now you're mostly electronic, right? With what you do on.
We are. Yep. Yeah. This was our second year where we've gone to the fun card system. Yes. That was a long time in the making. I mean, as you well know, and everybody listening, I mean, it's, you've got one shot at it. So, you know, we wanted to make sure that we could do it right. And we also didn't want to be the first, you know, we wanted to make sure that any system we used, it was proven somewhere else.
Yeah.
Just based on the volume that we do here. Absolutely. We didn't have any margin for error. You know, there's no soft open with the fair. So,
no.
This was a project that we were working on well before COVID. So, we're excited to see it finally come to fruition over the last couple of years and are pleased with the results.
And what works on the system? Just the rides and the, are the games and the food on there?
Rides and games, not food, but rides and games.
And now, do you see that being a thing throughout the whole fair eventually? Fairs in general, not just the Minnesota State Fair, but is there a time when it's going to be all on a, because a lot of like big concerts, big music festivals do it now where you have the wristband and it's all RFID, all NFC, and everything you buy has to come through the wristband. They're completely cashless. Do you see that happening with the fairs? I know there's a big, I don't want to say a big resistance because somebody will correct me, but you know, food vendors are a little tough about switching over. They don't love it right away, but they'll say it slows it down or they'll say whatever. I'm not sure that's true because you heard the same arguments when we were switching to tickets with like games and things like that back in the day. Mm-hmm. They'd say, oh, it slowed down, but in the end they liked it. But do you see a whole fair going completely cashless like that
eventually? You know, I mean, probably someday. I don't know if it will be in my lifetime, but I mean, I think what was interesting to me is just even credit card usage. I mean, when you talk about food vendors, you know, pre-COVID, there was very few of our food vendors that were taking credit cards. And now, you know, I mean, that COVID just really accelerated that. And mm-hmm. I think, you know, a lot of those vendors are seeing the benefits of that. So, you know, I don't think it's a matter of if, it's a matter of when. And I think a lot of that is driven by the consumer. You know, I mean, there are fewer and fewer people that are carrying cash and, the ease of being able to tap and go. So
yeah, and the younger generation, right? My daughters, I mean, I'm in this industry, so I used to carry around a little cash and things like that. I'll pull out some cash and they'll be like, "What are you? Why are you paying for that debt?" I was like, "Why? Why?" You know, it's like I'm a drug dealer or something. They can't get their mind around that people have cash sometimes. You know, it's like it's crazy, but. It wasn't that long ago. And I was talking to Matt Wallsmith at the South Florida Fair. We were discussing how COVID really pushed things forward, you know, so quickly. I mean, our industry, God love us, is a little slow to change with some things sometimes. Mm-hmm. You know, it happens over time. But COVID really pushed that envelope a little bit with the electronic or with the credit card usage and all the things that might have taken another 3 or 4 or 5 years to really happen. But it accelerated a lot of moves, you know, that otherwise no might not have happened at the time. So it's an interesting, because I'm curious to see how long it's going to be, because we could do it right now, right? You could go, boom,
you can switch everything over to a completely ticketing system. And I know there's, you know, a little bit of fear or trepidation about certain things, but you know, you could do it. It wouldn't, you know, it wouldn't be that impossible to do, but how long it's going to actually take to happen, I'm not sure.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, a lot of it has to do with what you have in place for infrastructure and, you know, and networks and, you know, Wi-Fi and all that kind of stuff. I mean, we see, you know, on our big days where suddenly, you know, cell service becomes a real problem. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I mean, I think making sure that you have the infrastructure in place, but I mean, Disney's been doing it for how long? But I think again, it's, we don't have a margin for error that we're not, you know, we don't have a soft open.
When we open, that's a scary thing about events, right? It's like you can't make a mistake. You can't.
Yeah. There's no, you know, you've got to make sure you've got it right, because you don't have the luxury of time once you open those gates.
Interesting. So coming into you definitely ease your way in because you went through all the categories and chairs and things like that. But what did you, when you became the CEO, you were like, what did you think your biggest learning curves or challenges were going to be facing you?
Yeah. You know, I mean, I think the, I was fortunate, you know, I've been here for, you know, going on 20 years and, you know, I was very lucky that, you know, Jerry spent a lot of time and, you know, I was part of leadership for a long time. I think it's just, you know, I knew a lot of the little segments. It was bringing it all together. So, you know, just
making sure you had all the keys to the buildings.
Yeah, exactly. But I mean, just, I think, you know, the full financial picture, working with a board in a different capacity than I have before, which, I mean, they've been great. They've been very supportive, but I mean, that's a different thing when you report to a board as opposed to, you know, as opposed to a supervisor. So, just kind of keeping a handle on everything. And I think, I'm very much a doer. So kind of moving into that role of knowing I need to step back and, you know, it's that 38 special song, you got to hold on loosely, but don't let go. So just really, you know, providing support and direction where needed, but also letting people to do their jobs. And, you know, so kind of moving into that, you know, and then now just really looking kind of long-term, what are our long-term plans and thinking strategically about what the fair will look like 20 years from now, 30 years from now, and maintaining it for generations to come.
Yeah. And you know, it's funny. You struck a thought with me is they must have a great culture there about mentoring people and really teaching them how to lead. Because I, you know, in some ways, like, you know, some people are completely hands-on and smother you and you know, tell you what to do. And I saw it with Rick in Ohio and I think Jerry was very similar from what I've heard. But they let the people under them do their jobs, even make mistakes once in a while, you know, so they could learn from it. And I always found that, I always admired, you know, them for that, because that's hard to do. You know, me, I'm like kind of like you, like, oh, I got to go pick it up if he's going to drop it, or I got to go get that. But to be able to sit back and let the people learn the thing, it's really, and they, you know, I don't know where that came from, or it must be in the culture there, but it's, I see it a lot in, at your event and the people that have come from your base of operations there.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I think that was probably what really, you know, drew me in at the very beginning, even as an intern. I mean, like the level of responsibility you have, even as a summer employee or a 12-day employee. And I think part of it is just necessity out of the size and scope of the operation. It's like, you can't do everything. So you've got to learn to let go and give people, you know, the ability to just run with things. And, you know, and I think that's part of why people stick around too. I mean, they're doing meaningful work. It's, they're seeing, you know, I mean, as you said, I mean, it's hard work. There's no question about it. It's long hours. It's can be a pressure cooker. But you also see the fruits of your labor. You see, you know, family and friends and neighbors and people from all across the state coming and enjoying what you've worked all year long to create. So
it's really fulfilling.
It really is fulfilling. There's no question about it. And I think, again, it's being able to give people the ability to just kind of run with things is something that gives people the ability to enjoy it.
That is special. When I was going, getting my MBA, and I was working at the Leukemia Society, like raising money. And I remembered I had to do all these celebrity waiter dinner stuff where I had to bother people to raise money. You know, it's like, oh, I don't have to call this person up and they don't really want to do this. And I remembered my church in New Jersey used to raise money from a carnival somehow. So I, you know, did some, there was actually one right across the street. So I went there. I said, how do you raise money from this thing? And they talked to me, but it struck me that it was so cool to raise money from people that were smiling and happy to give it to you and having a great time. You know, as a byproduct, we raised a lot of money, but right. They were so happy to do it. You know, I wasn't bugging them. I wasn't asking them to sell some, you know, donuts or pencils or some crazy thing they didn't want to sell. And you know, that for me, I was like, this is wonderful. You know, people are having a great time and it's doing a lot of good. And it was just, it really struck me. And you reminded me of that when you were just saying what you were saying.
Yeah. Well, and it's like, I even think you brought up a great point as a precursor to all of this foreshadowing, whatever you want to call it. I remember in grade school, like the neighbor kids and I, do you remember MDA carnivals? We put on muscular.
The ones you did yourself in your backyard.
Yes, yeah, I do remember. We did a backyard carnival. You know, they send you the kit with, you know, a few things and then you make it all yourself. And you're raising money for muscular dystrophy. So
I remember that you sent in a check for like $500,000. I knew you were going to be a success.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. That was
as a 10-year-old.
That was probably $50.
Yeah, I do remember those things. There's like a little kit. I do remember that.
Yeah.
That's great. The structure of the Minnesota State Fair, is it state supported? I don't think I know, honestly.
No. So we are quasi-state agency. We don't receive any government funds, but we are governing. We're governed. Yeah, we're governed by state statute. We have a board of managers that are elected by the delegates of the Minnesota State Agricultural Society, which is made up primarily of county fairs throughout the state and other statewide organizations. So our board is representing the entire state of Minnesota. They come from the 9 congressional districts from 1933. So we have a lot of great outstate representation on our board. But again, we don't receive any government funds. We've bounced around we've been around since before the Minnesota was a state since 1854. Yeah. We've been in this location. This is state-owned property since 1885, but we're the ones that invest everything into keeping up the 320 acres and keeping it running. We also have a nonprofit. We have a foundation, a 501c3, that also whose primary responsibility is to raise funds to preserve and support the state fair.
Yeah, I saw early on in your history, you bounced around. I always thought that, you know, for the right state, that might be a good idea to move a little bit in different, if you have different big cities in a state or something like that, it might be an interesting, and plus you get bid it out, like get bids and then they invest a lot of money to bring the state fair to kind of like they used to do with the World's Fair. It might be an interesting idea. And you did it for quite a few years.
We did. And I can't imagine now, that the size that we are moving this thing around.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking too. Yeah.
Just the challenges of what that would bring that would be a lot.
Unless you got some cities that have some big money or something. Along they're really motivated to do it. That's great. So let's touch on entertainment. Entertainment, mm-hmm. You guys do have a nice little oasis a little bit where you're the Minnesota State Fair and people still want to play it and do it, but it's changed a whole lot since you were the entertainment director, huh? Grandstand.
I'm still booking the grandstand. I kept up with that piece. I am. Yeah. It's something that I got. Well, it's something that I still, really love. And it's like so much of this business, it's about relationships. So, I've built the relationships with the agents, for the last 20 years. So we book direct, which we're able to do that just based on our size and what we are. And it's certainly a passion project for me. It's certainly changed. There's a lot more competition, obviously, in our market, just like so many other markets. We've got, two major arenas. We've got 1, 2, 3 major stadiums that are also doing shows. The one thing that we don't currently have, but I think that will be changing soon, is an amphitheater of any size. So that's one thing that is not currently in our market. But yeah, I mean, it's our grandstand is 14,000 seats, and we do concerts, you know, all 11 of the 12 nights. Our 12th night we do, well, our last day we do a kids show during the day, and we also do our talent contest finals on the Sunday. So 10 nights of hard ticket grandstand shows. I'm about 50% done for next year already. So things have really changed. I mean, it used to be, wouldn't even start looking at artists until the IAFE convention in Vegas. And now, you know, going into the end of the year and being halfway done, it's a different pace than what it used to be. There's no question about it.
So you're going to announce who you have?
No, I'm not yet. No.
Come on. So, I gotta
hopefully we'll have a show on sale before the end of the year, but still.
So that whole buying process, like you said, has changed. Yeah. And it's gotten so expensive. I mean, do you still make money with all the show? You guys do really well with everything, but.
There's some years that are better than others. I mean, just based on, you know, I think we saw kind of an evening out with entertainment this past year. You know, I think there was a lot of pent up demand from the public side coming out of COVID of people wanting to go see shows, and also artists that wanted to get out and tour. And last year we saw a little bit of leveling off on both cases, where, you know, the ticket sales maybe weren't as strong as they had been the previous couple of years, and less artists that were out touring. I mean, they're getting back more on more of a cycle of, you know, a year touring, a year off recording and that type of thing. So a little different. Yeah,
a couple of big tours canceled because of soft ticket sales. I guess I'm just super conservative with that, but I just don't think you can keep raising prices forever. You know, it just doesn't work. You know, there's to be some place where they say uncle and they give up because I mean, some tickets are just, I can't believe it. Or some of the artists are getting are just crazy too. You know, it's such a big number.
Yeah. I mean, that's the driver is the guarantee. You know, I mean, it's that we're setting ticket prices based on what, you know, the artist guarantee. And I was just at AIBA, International Entertainment Buyers Association conference in Nashville. In October. And some of the price quotes, I think I've seen some things coming down.
Have you?
Good. Which is good. Yeah. Yeah. Leveling off a little bit. I mean, they're not down to, you know, but it's not quite as crazy as it was the last couple of years.
Yeah, I mean, it's shocking. It's like you can't even predict. I mean, I was looking at some of my kids went to go see Zach Brown and I think Megan Maroney opened for him. And, you know, she had I didn't know much about her. She had a hit or two. I'm not really a big country person. But they're like, you should get her. And I was like, okay, she's an opening act. How much could I was like, what? Like, how much? Are you kidding me?
Yeah.
I can't believe, you know, it's like it wasn't that long ago that you could buy some people affordably, but you know, I don't know what the smaller county fairs are doing, you know, or how they can, how they can even have a prayer of doing anything with some of these shows.
Yeah. Yeah. There's no question. I mean, you've got to get creative. And I mean, I just had the conversation. So in addition to our grandstand, we also have 5 free stages that we book and program, you know, all day, every day for 12 days. And our band shell stage, which is about a 5,000 person capacity. There was a particular artist and I was looking at this weekend, and I mentioned it to our buyer, and he made the call. And, you know, kind of our top end for that particular stage is, you know, it's usually a 2-day run, and we usually pay on the top end $60,000 for 2. And this particular artist was $500,000. I'm like, how did that even happen?
And some of them can't sell a hard ticket and they're getting big money. It's unbelievable. Yeah, it's like, you know, some of them you go like,
and have maybe a song, you know, don't have enough for a full 90 minute set, you know? So, it's definitely different. I mean, but I think what's really exciting is there's just the diversity of music has changed so much. You know, it used to be country, rock, those were your 2 choices. And now there are so many different genres. We had great success with comedy. This past year, we had Nate Bargatze, which was super fun. So it's great to see. We had Becky G, so, you know, bringing in a Latin influence. hip hop. You know, I mean, the music is so much more segmented than it ever was before, and being able to look at different genres and really hit a lot of different things is that's fun for me and really a challenge to try and to bring, you know, a real diverse lineup every year.
And then on your old stomping grounds on free acts, those have changed quite a bit too, since like the animal acts have gone away almost completely.
Yeah.
Since COVID, you know, I've got some friends that had, you know, pretty big shows. They just mm-hmm. went off the road and did the things, but that, you know, it seems like there's a lot of sort of, I don't want to say consolidation because that's not the right word, but there's a lot of sameness. You know, there's like 10 like circus acts that do Globe of Death and two other things. And there's yeah. not a lot of that. I think there needs to be some, you know, a little bit of breath of fresh air into that free act industry, because I see a lot of the same, you know, when you go yeah. to these conventions and things.
Yeah. Yeah. No question. Yeah. I mean, and I think that's, you know, being in the live entertainment business, we need to compel people to get off their couch and come out and
participate
and experience and participate. And, you know, bring something that they maybe don't, that they can't get from home. And I think, you know, the biggest part of that is like being with other people, you know, and just how important that is to all of us as a community, to just spend time with one another and realize that we have more in common than we do not. You know, I mean, I think that's what fairs bring about. I mean, I have, you know, some of my most heartwarming stories have happened with strangers out here at the fair, you know, a few years ago, our food building, which was, you know, when you're working during the fair, and you probably know this, it's like when you're hungry, it's like whatever's closest that doesn't have a line. So out my back door is the food building, which was this, you know, this incredible, you know, poo-poo platter of anything I could ever want. So I was walked across to get a wild rice burger and some waffle fries. And I was coming out of the building and a woman came up to me and she had a boat of cheese curds. And she said, "I will trade you a cheese curd for a waffle fry." And I said, "You know, you can just have a waffle fry. I don't need cheese curds." She's like, "No, these are fresh. You have to have one." So we had this moment. I have her cheese curd, agreed. Yes, they were excellent. She had a waffle fry and we went on our merry way. And I just thought, nowhere else does that happen. Nowhere else do you have an exchange with people like that, where you're sharing food with complete strangers and have a conversation and there's nothing wrong, nothing strange about it. You know, I mean, I think that's just what's so special about what we do.
I don't know about the rice burger.
It's fantastic. It's mostly ground beef, but then there's wild rice peppered into it.
There is ground beef. Tasty. Okay, I thought it was one of those veggie burgers.
No, it's not. No, it's wild rice with the ground beef. So
I was getting sarcastic.
Yeah, and I had another situation this year. I was just sitting on a bench. You know, one of my favorite things is just like watching people watch how they're experiencing the fair. And a guy came up to me, and I don't think I had a lanyard on or anything. And he came up with a cup that was almost gone of our Sweet Martha's cookies. And he said, "I got the smallest size I could. There's a handful left. You take them or I'm going to throw them away." So of course I took his cookies, you know, and that doesn't happen anywhere.
Of course I took his cookies. Yeah. I was going to say, I thought it was a real rice burger. I was going to say, no wonder why there's no line.
No, they're very good and they're very popular. So,
yeah, I was going back to the free entertainment a second. I think I was having dinner somewhere or something. One night it was like, I was by myself. So I was kind of like at the bar and I looked up and there was a show on that I was fascinated with for like an hour. It was like one of these video shows, but they had people with like talents that were doing things. And some of the things were incredible. And I was thinking, some of these people could be performing at the fair. It'd be great. Right. I wonder if anybody's like looking at that stuff or paying attention, you know, these yeah. agents or whatever they're doing, because there were some great acts that could be great fair acts, you know, that yeah. there were dozens mm-hmm. of them. It was mm-hmm. crazy.
So like America's Got Talent or something like that. Was it?
Yeah. Something? It wasn't actually like a formal show. Is that like, they're just people submitting videos, like some kind of video, some weird wow. channel that all they did was show videos yeah. of, I mean, some people are doing completely nuts things like skateboarding off their roof or, you know, something like that. But yeah. some people had some really cool little acts they were doing that. I said, I wonder if somebody's taking advantage of that and really moving. I think by the time they get in America's Got Talent, they already got an agent and they're already pretty far along, and they're probably expensive already. And they say, oh, I was on America's Got Talent. Did you win? No, I came in 65th, but I still won $4,000 a day, you know, to come over. I was like,
oh. Exactly. Yeah. You know, one of the things that we've been doing for more than 50 years is our amateur talent contest. And, you know, we, like I said, we do that in the grandstand on Labor Day weekend, and we'll have 5,000, 6,000, 7,000 people there to watch. And it's incredible the talent people have. And it's, you know, I mean, we do it all the way from the littles all the way up to adults. And, you know, we have everything from vocalists to dancers to jugglers to this year's winner was a cello player. So the talent really runs the gamut. You know, it's not just your run of the mill type thing. So it is pretty incredible the talent that people have.
Yeah. And those can be fun. And those are like creative. Like I was at the consulting at the Florida State Fair a couple of years, and they had a dance competition. And I was like, you know, it'd be cool. I hired for the finals a couple of people from Dance Moms to be the judges, you know, when it was big. And the night before, we had like local celebrities, like the Tampa cheerleaders, whatever. And, you know, they did like little videos, like, you know, enter now, because first it was, you know, they would submit something and then we'd pick however many finalists and then went on through. But, you know, to add like a little celebrity judging or something like that helps with the viewership, make it a little more of an event. And you're just a little creative. You know, there's a lot of things you could do to really, you know, make something that you might not otherwise think would be that big a draw into like an act itself, you know, in a way.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I think the other thing is, I mean, you know, talking about county fairs, I mean, it's a low budget way to program a stage. And, you know, we joke when you have a big dance group, it's like, well, each kid is going to bring mom and dad and grandma and grandpa and brothers and sisters. So suddenly you've boosted your attendance, you know, through your, you know, local participation with the talent contest.
Yeah. And that's the sort of organic way to do it from the ground up. I mean, mm-hmm. you can do it somewhat with advertising, but it's more of a, you need that foundation, and that brings you the foundation is the participation from the locals and the people that are, that are, you know, make up your fair, make up your community. Absolutely. And participate in the community. So that's really cool. Have you, you know, I had a thought before, I'm kind of going back a little bit, but you know, I've wondered this for a while. Have any fairs ever tried to like get together to book some of these grandstand acts? Like, you know, cause you know, how many Labor Day fairs is a million of them. So, you know, if you get 5 or 6 or 7, you can book a whole week's worth of shows or something, you know?
Yeah. I mean, I don't think that there's anything formally that's happening. I do, you know, informally, you know, I'm usually talking with other buyers. I mean, and there's some that happens when you look at, you know, if you're working with a third party producer who's, you know, they may have their own route of fairs based on how, you know, who their clients are. But yeah, I mean, I'm, you know, talked with, you know, like the New York State Fair happens the same time that we do the Allentown Fair in Pennsylvania, Alaska State Fair, Nebraska. So yeah, I'm usually, you know, I'm talking with those folks and we'll try and do some of our own little mini routing. Mm-hmm. But I think, you know, the challenge is, you know, market by market and budgets are different and, you know, and it gets a little, a little squishy just based on, you know, there may be something that would do incredibly well in the Minneapolis St. Paul market that is not going to play well in Nebraska and vice versa. So, you know, I mean, I think that's the challenge is, you know, when you really get down to it, that it sometimes it's not a little tougher than you realize from the surface.
You know, just for my own personal question, excuse me. Did you ever book any of the, like the big Minneapolis St. Paul bands that were big when you were growing up, going to college and high school?
Like the Suicide Commandos or the Suburbs or Soul Asylum. Soul Asylum just played our free stage last year. So the Jayhawks have played, Semisonic played this year.
Husker Du
was, I've had Bob Mould. Though. We've had Bob. Yeah.
The drummer died last year before.
Yeah. So
their placements got together because I was working with the music festival that put them together. And I said, that would be a cool thing for the Minnesota State Fair to have the Replacements or one of those big.
I had an offer on them a few years ago. And because they did, I saw them, they were doing a baseball tour. And then I think they did some stuff with, they go with Green Day maybe for a little while. But no, I mean, I love the Replacements. Yeah.
I did too.
That
was great to watch those shows because it was my, I love them from college and it was just great.
Yeah. Well,
to watch.
I mean, I think that's, I mean, this is such a music town, you know, I mean,
it is. Yeah. It's such a rich history of all those.
Yeah. It really is. No Prince shows. Unfortunately. Yeah. No.
There's a couple good Prince tribute acts though, but.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And we've had, I mean, members of his band have played here in different, you know, forms of, you know, one way with other bands, that kind of thing. So, yeah.
That's neat. So let's move to food a little bit. What are some of your favorite foods there? How many new vendors do you have each year? Or do you have like a target number you try to move around? Or is it just based upon how well things did the year before or how?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's every year it's kind of dependent upon, I mean, while it's a year-to-year license, I mean, most of our vendors return year after year. So it's a matter of, you know, who's decided to get out of the business and that will a lot of times then determine where spots open up and, you know, how we fill those spots. You know, I think there's a myth, you know, from people outside of the business that we just go to the file and you pull who's next on the waiting list, so to speak. And, you know, it's for us, it's much more about curating who those vendors are and where, and the space that we have open. You know, is it a spot for a trailer? Is it a spot inside of a building? You know, what the product mix is. And I think, you know, we have a really great mix. I think one of the things that we really are successful at is just a real mix of those traditional fair foods along with a lot of local, you know, for lack of restaurateurs. You know, we've got some great vendors that have brick and mortar spots, you know, that are also have a space here. So it's fun to have kind of a real mix. And we typically average between 3 and 6 new vendors a year. And then new foods, you know, that's always our big announcement of the year. And this year, I think we had 33 new foods. So we've got our new foods committee and they sit in the basement of our administration building and the vendors can bring in samples if they want. And there's a bottle of Tums in the middle of the table and and they take one for the team by, you know, trying all the different foods and really curating that list as well. And I, you know, one of the things we really strive for again is diversity there, you know, from, you know, different dietary, different ethnic foods that we bring in. So just really, you know, try and have as broad of an offerings as we can from a food perspective.
And you weigh that against, I guess, popularity to a certain extent, right? I mean,
oh yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think when you look at kind of the top five, they're single product vendors, you know, it's the cookies, it's
French fry guy,
you know, French fries, it's corn roast, you know, it's malts. I mean, they do one product and they do it really, really well. You know, mixing in those other new foods is I think really the secret to the success.
And you have like the contest for the best new food for the year?
We do not. We don't do a contest. Nope.
Really?
No, there are other fairs that do. I mean, I think the Iowa State Fair and the Wisconsin State Fair both do contests, but we just throw it out there and then let people decide. But there's what's interesting is the media frenzy that happens on that opening day. There are a couple food writers, food critics who will go and try all of the new foods and put their ratings out there. And, you know, it's interesting how there will be, you know, we'll try and guess what we think will be the sleeper hit or, you know, kind of the one that rises to the top. And sometimes we're spot on and other times we're way off base.
Is there a way you denote where the new foods are? Or do you have like a little map or anything like that?
You can pick up, it's on our, on our app. You can search by new foods. And then we also, you can pick up a brochure at any of our info booths.
That's pretty cool. Your fair is definitely known for food. I mean, everybody.
We are
loves the food, food on a stick, and vendor wise on the business side, that, you know, Minnesota is a big, big event for a lot of people.
Throughout the course of the year. And the other thing that's also become a big deal is our specialty sips. So it's craft brewers that are coming up with different flavors and slushies and, you know, all the different craft brewers that are, you know, Minnesota based that are also out here is a big deal for a lot of folks.
Yeah. It's becoming a big deal, mm-hmm. So capital improvement wise and moving on, you said you got some projects coming up, but is there mm-hmm. anything you, mm-hmm. you specifically have in mind that you're
working on? Yeah. I mean, our big one that will be starting in April is our Coliseum. So our Coliseum is probably our most used building throughout the year, calendar year, aside from hosting horse shows and livestock competitions during the fair. There's horse shows, livestock shows that happen throughout the summer, and then the winter it turns into a dry floor space where we do, you know, different trade shows and roller girls and those types of events. And building's about 75 years old and need of some TLC. So we're starting with a roof project in the spring, and then we'll be doing some additional improvements, electrical and new seating and restrooms and that kind of thing. So that's we're really kind of on that. We've done a lot of great new construction over the course of the last several years, and now our focus is really on preserving a lot of our historic buildings and taking care of what we've got there.
That's great. What other big challenges do you see coming up for you as the head of the Minnesota State Fair there? I read you were talking about 80-20. You like to do 80% the same and 20% new, which I think is a great way to put it, because it is important, because you always have to have something new to bring in.
Yeah, you know. I think keeping it fresh. I mean, I think the biggest challenge is expenses are rising, and how do you keep the fair affordable? You know, so, you know, making sure that you don't price yourself out of the market, but still be able to take care of the facilities that we have and the fairgrounds. So I think that's the biggest challenge, is looking for, you know, kind of determining other revenue sources or what we can do to make sure that families can still afford to come to the fair and have a good time and feel like, I mean, it's an expense for a family, right?
Yeah.
But that they feel like that they got a value for it, that it was worth it. You know,
I think it's not just the really mentality of coming once. You know, I think that's where we differ is as events like us, because, you know, ideally you want to see them coming a couple of times, a couple, three, maybe more, you know, times. So mm-hmm. it's not mm-hmm. just like, well, they can afford it, spend whatever, you know, $300 on that day. But but I want them to come like three, four times, you know.
Yeah.
Now you're talking $1,200. It's a different number than the other number. So keeping it affordable. I think you're at like $17. I think I saw for your attendance.
We were at 18 this year. 18. At the gate. But we have a lot of discounts. We always do a flash sale around the holidays. So there are ways, you know, there's a lot of ways to do the fair on a budget. You just have to plan, just like everything. You know, if you want to go quick and not worry about the expense, that's one way, or you can plan out and purchase tickets in advance, get a coupon book, those types, you know, come early in the day for, you know, early bird discounts and try and offer, you know, different options for folks.
Yeah. I think, you know, I think about that a lot, pricing and whether mm-hmm. it's wristbands on the midway or admission or how things are growing. And, you know, some fairs have different challenges, like some can't handle, they only have so much capacity or whatever. They can't handle a lot more than what they're doing. I was talking to somebody the other day, and, you know, because I think a thing that's overlooked a lot, and I don't know how much we could do it or what events we could do it, but maybe having like a premium experience, like at a amusement park, you know, might be a way for some of these fairs, especially that are capacity limited, to go in. So that way you can keep your base price low for the people that want to come and do things, but also order, like you said, offer a premium experience where there's, you know, VIP parking and, you know, skip the line mm-hmm. type thing on the rides, and maybe priority seating at some of the shows and things like that, where you could charge quite a bit more and still, you know, maybe keep that bottom end low where the people can still afford to come on another basis. I like to do things in general that are not that are their choice. In other words, I want them to come. Mm-hmm. Now, if they want to spend more to get this and that and the other thing, great, you know, but I don't want to prevent them from coming too, you know, that's, I don't know.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. And I think the other thing is, you know, knowing that, I mean, when a family comes to the fair, they're looking at what the whole day costs. They're not breaking out what they spent on gate versus what they spent on ride. I mean, on food. I mean, they're looking at the full day and what it cost them from beginning to end. So, you know, kind of looking at each of those kind of revenue points and making sure that it's affordable. But yeah, also, are there ways where we can provide, you know, more, you know, kind of more defined experiences where you pay a premium for them?
Yeah, and getting that barrier to entry like you're talking about. So the gate price is so psychologically such a big thing to get in, you know, because I think once you get them, they'll spend the money because they have to, because their kids are going to drive crazy and whatever else. But, you know, if they see like that initial price is high, and I'm not talking about the Minnesota State Fair specifically, I'm just talking about events in general. You know, if that big number is like, oh, it's going to cost us whatever, $80 to walk through the gate, you know, they might back up, whereas they might have spent a whole lot of money, you know, had they come and maybe gotten just a little cheaper, you know, you're probably way ahead, but who knows?
Yeah. Yeah. So that's a big challenge, I think,
for it is.
Events as a whole.
And depending upon how the economy
aging, is. Aging infrastructure that we need to maintain and, you know, still remain affordable for folks.
So one of my writers was asking me, and you know, I guess I'm completely, I don't want to say oblivious because I just didn't really think about it much, but he's talking about how many, I'm assuming you're the first female CEO of the Minnesota State Fair.
Yep.
And there's been quite a few others, apparently. You know, personally, I never even thought about it. I just, you know, Renee runs the Minnesota State Fair. You know, this one runs that one. I never really thought about, you know, gender or anything like that. But, you know, was that like a big deal to become the first, or did you not think about it either? You just kind of earned it after being there so many years, and that's kind of
I mean, I think it's, you know, it's a challenge. I mean, I think my hope is, you know, that I got the job because I was the most qualified person for the job, and I happen to bring to the table that I'm a female. So, I mean, but I mean, there's no question that the industry has certainly changed from when I started as an intern years ago. I mean, I don't hardly recall any women that were running fairs back in 1989. And, you know, there was a period of time here not long ago where there were three Renees running fairs. So it was Renee McLean in Washington, Renee Korslein in North Dakota, and me. So that was, I mean, you know, it's not that common of a name. And for there to be three of us at the helm of three great fairs was pretty special. So
did they make a big deal about it in the press and whatnot when you became,
you know, interesting. They did not. I mean, there was a little bit about it, but not, it was not blown out of proportion. I think, you know, you talk a little bit about, I mean, the fair means a lot to the people of Minnesota. I mean, there is such a sense of pride about this fair, and we take that very seriously. I mean, we look at it as we're the stewards, you know, we're the caretakers of this place that means a lot to the people of Minnesota. And I think a lot of the press was, people were, and kind of the feedback, public feedback was that people were relieved it was somebody from the inside, that it wasn't an outsider who was going to come in from somewhere outside of Minnesota and mess up their fair. The fact that it was somebody who had a long-standing career here, you know, I wasn't coming in to turn things upside down. It was, we're going to stay the course and we'll tweak as we go. But it wasn't about, you know, I'm going to come in here and put my stamp on it because I'm an outsider. So that was more of what kind of the public sentiment was like, oh, good, it's one of us.
Yeah, and I think that's good. I mean, I think because the story came up, he wanted to do a story, you know, he pitched me a story about, I think it was because the African-American lady became head of, I think it's Arkansas State Fair. And he said, is that the only black female fair manager? I said, I have no idea. I really don't. I mean, I see people's names. I don't, you know, I don't know everybody. I know some people. I never really thought about it, honestly, because I think we kind of do, or at least recently, have been pretty, you know, good about promoting whoever's the best person. And I, you know, I think that it's important what matters. And I, you know, most people I talk to about it, they seem to have the same, I didn't think about that. I just wanted to run the thing. Yeah. And I had the most experience and I did the best. And I, you know, I think that's great that those opportunities exist for everyone, no matter where you are, as long as you're capable of doing the job.
Yeah. I mean, it's a unique industry. And I think, you know, to have somebody come from, you know, we're not like CEOs of major of Fortune 500 companies where you're going to bounce around from one to another. It's, mm-hmm. you know, you're usually in this business because you love it. And it takes, you know, a certain fortitude to do what we do in the live event space, you know? So, you know, I think it's about, you know, again, you don't see a lot of situations where somebody without fair experience ends up in a leadership role at a major fair.
Now, I was thinking about that for Minnesota, especially. I was like, if they went on one of these nationwide searches where they're looking for the fair manager, I just don't know it would work there because your culture is so strong and the things you do are so strong and you have such a strong yeah. bench, you know, it would be, you know, unless it was some, I can't even imagine this scenario, yeah. but it makes sense to me that they groom from within, hired from within, you know, you've been there a long time and then you move up and, you know, unless you were at some kind of crossroads where roads where things were going poorly and you needed a drastic yeah. change.
But. Yeah. I mean, I think that's what, when you see, you know, regardless of the industry, you know, if an organization is on the right course, they're usually going to stay internal. You know, it's like, to your point, if things are not going well, that's when you start looking external. But you're right. I mean, we've got so much talent here. I mean, we've got just an incredible staff and, you know, we value and have such great institutional knowledge. I mean, Jim Sinclair is still on payroll, you know, Jim's still helping out with the Midway and transferring his knowledge. And
I'm surprised you didn't dump him after what he did to you. Jim, and, you remember when I interviewed
Jerry
with you?
Jerry Hammer lives down the street and, you know, is around and, you know, just a phone call away and around the fairgrounds. So yeah, and that's incredible to have that historical knowledge that we can tap into. And yeah, and we're very fortunate that people make a career of being here and continue on.
Well, what are a couple of the places that really make the fairgrounds special? Like what attractions do you have that are really.
What attractions? I mean, honestly, I think it's just, I think part of what makes us so special is just the grounds themselves. I mean, we have hundreds of trees and mm-hmm. tree-lined streets, and then the amount of structures that we have here that are, you know, our grandstand is over 100 years old. We have buildings that were built during WPA, you know, these Art Deco style buildings. And so I think it's the place itself.
The Midway is like an afterthought. It's in the back, you know, it's like not.
Yeah. Yeah. But I mean, it has a sense of permanency to it. That feels, you know, like it's been here for a long time. So I think the place itself, and I think it's just, I mean, I think it's just, we have neighborhoods. I mean, it feels very neighborhoody, and I've, you know, there's been some great articles written about, the fair, you know, is a perfect example of what city planners should be looking at. You know, it's walkable. There's outdoor dining. It's accessible mm-hmm. for people. It's safe. And, you know, the things that we provide in that kind of community space is pretty incredible. Yeah. So, and I mean, I can't, you know, I don't want to say, I don't want to call out favorites. It's all my favorites.
All your children, no one's your
all
favorite.
All my children, exactly.
That's great. Well, excuse me. It sounds like you've got lots you've done already and lots you're going to be doing with the Minnesota State Fair. Your attendance, I think you're getting just about where pre-COVID levels were, pretty close.
Yep. Yeah, last year we had 1.9 million, so it was, yeah, our highest attendance since COVID. You know, we were over 2 million in 2019. So you know, and for us, it's less about, you know, I mean, that attendance number is what everybody grabs onto, but for us, it's about creating the best experience that we can. Yeah,
that's great, and that's what you said. Your focus was going to be on the customer experience mm-hmm. in there. Mm-hmm. So, I think you've done that, and you're continuing to do that, which is awesome. And we want to congratulate you for doing such a great job and for coming on today and talking with us about the Great Minnesota Get Together, right?
Yes, the Great Minnesota Get Together.
And
12 days of fun ending Labor Day.
That's right. That's right. And such a great event and such a leader. And we'll be looking for you, all the things you do coming up, and hopefully we'll have you back on before too long. Great. Thank you so much for coming on, Renee.
Thanks so much for having me. It was a real pleasure.
All right. We'll talk to you soon.
Okay.
This podcast is brought to you by Innovative Ticketing is the ticketing source made for the amusement industry. Our staff of professionals can guide you through your setup, assist with customer service, even on the weekends when you most need it, and help increase your sales through promotions that work. Innovative Ticketing is the ticketing source made for the amusement industry. Sign up today at innovativeticketing.com.